Admiral Zumwalt remembers that his first contact with you took place at the Naval War College, where he had given a presentation based upon his research there, and that it attracted your attention. The director was speaking with you and wanted to speak with you about something else, but the conversation kept coming back to this young officer who had done this study on succession in the Soviet Union. And my question is, what was it about Admiral Zumwalt at the time that attracted your attention to him?
Given a speech, I believe the speech was on the subject of China, and the long-range future of our relation with China, which I believe referred to the speech I'd made at all. Because here I'd given, what did he speak about? And they said he spoke of the problem of succession in a communist, in Russia. Mm-hmm. And talk about this humiliation of that. But I decided to marry him. Kaiser, of course, was to marry him. Medberg was the... And said, you have a lieutenant commander by the name of Zumwalt working in the Navy. Anti-aircraft missile destroyer. And that's a very important position for us, and also for his career. And I said, do you want me to take it up with McNamara, or do you want to give it some further thought? And I know that McNamara, he's guaranteed me that anybody I want to have work for me, he will see to it that I get. Mm-hmm. And Smedberg said, well, he'd like to think about it for an hour. I said, well, no problem, but be sure to do it within the hour. So Smitty called me up and he said, well, we've thought about it further and decided that this wouldn't necessarily be bad for Zumwalt's career. And it might be good for him and for the Navy. And so therefore we've agreed to let him do what you suggest he should do. And so Bud came and reported for me for duty within the hour. And it all worked out very well indeed, I think, for him and for me as well, because he turned out to be have all kinds of qualifications. He could write a speech. He was good on working out the ins and outs of policy decisions, facts, figures that bore upon the decisions, how they might, all that might be resolved. And he spoke well, had a certain eloquence, and he had the qualities of character and loyalty that have distinguished him in his career ever since. So that's how we got together.
Was he given a choice when you wanted to bring him to your office? If I remember correctly, the detailer in the Navy told him that I don't think this is a good idea for you to do this, but I'll let you do it if you want to. And Admiral Zumwalt then said, he thought about it and said, I want to do it.
I guess that's correct. Yeah.
And I think that's very interesting that in terms of a Navy career, that he makes such an important decision so quickly. And there must have been some initial rapport between you and him that would make him decide to make that leap.
I don't think there was any. I don't think I'd ever seen him. That's my recollection.
How would you account then for the decision you make to bring him over to work for you, and how he, sight unseen, will then decide to do that, but even though he's been warned that this might not be a career-enhancing move?
I think he'd followed my career with some interest for some reason or other. Well, after all, I was Secretary of the Navy. And junior officers took a great deal of interest in what their secretary was like.
Mm-hmm.
And I had there was an admiral by the name of Shea, S-C-H-O-E, who was the senior admiral in charge of the bureaus reporting to the Secretary of the Navy. The Navy organization is very strange. All the bureaus reported not to the CNO, but to a particular admiral who reported directly. They reported through one admiral to the Secretary of the Navy, not through the CNO, not through the Chief of Naval Operations. There was a division between operations and policy. Friends in the Navy young lieutenant commander who's in the a lawyer working in the Navy. He had gone to a staff meeting. Shea had held. Shea had told his staff that the Navy faced a serious problem. They had a secretary who didn't understand the role of the civilian secretary of the Navy. This secretary seemed to think that he had some degree of authority over the Navy. He didn't realize that the Secretary of the Navy was a civilian to be much admired by everybody in the Navy, but to be admired and made much of, but no one should let him live under the illusion that he had any power with respect to what went on in the Navy. That was reserved to the admirals. And I called up Shea and asked him what I told him that in rumor he'd said something like this. Was it true or not? He'd said. And Shea, being a very honest man, said, no, it was true, he had said it, and meant it. And I said, well, you're fired. No explanation of any kind. He said, God damn it, I didn't think you'd have the guts.
I suppose he respected you after that, sir.
And so we really became, he was fired, but we became, we had a mutual admiration society. despite the fact that I'd fired him, because he damn well knew I should have fired him. And he spoke truth when he said he didn't think I'd have the guts to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So we maintained our mutual respect for many years after that, even though he left the Navy. Where were we at? Wonderful.
Well, that's okay. Admiral Zumwalt came to work for you. What was his official capacity? He told me that he initially was on a country desk for Spain and Portugal, and not too long after that was placed in a higher position, a billet that was normally reserved for a rank higher than he actually had. And it is in this capacity that he works with you during important events like the missile crisis, the negotiations for the test ban treaty, and if you could recall how he came to have that role and what kind of work he did in it.
It's my recollection that I that after I'd fired at Brochet, I came to the conclusion that I needed someone working directly on my staff who would keep me alert as to what was going on amongst the uniformed animals.
Yeah.
And I Bud to do that. Rest.
So he was your aide with regard to dealing with the uniformed Navy.
He was my eyes and ears to keep me informed about what they were interested and unhappy about.
And how did you perceive his performance in that role? I suppose that's a difficult position to have to...
Well, no, I didn't. I thought he was... I thought he was a very talented young officer. He had... He could draft a speech, he could make a speech, he could analyze policy decisions, he could make recommendations, all the pros and cons and considerations to bear in mind with respect to this decision or that decision. Bright, alert, competent, and loyal, man of character. So I came to think the world of him.
Mm-hmm. Did he write many of the speeches that you gave in your capacity as Secretary of the Navy?
I think he helped prepare drafts for me. I never did. Never believed in making a speech that I hadn't worked out the final draft of.
Mm-hmm.
happy, speechless, and it reflected my own character.
Mm-hmm. So he would basically lay groundwork for you, and you would you would build on that.
And he would prepare crap for me. No, I repeat, I don't believe I ever made a speech enough to rewrite the final text myself.
Mm-hmm. One of the big events that took place when he worked for you was the Cuban Missile Crisis, and he remembers that that naturally, of course, was a very difficult, very high-pressure time. And this is one of the things, I think, that where he plays an important role in working with you in drafting policy positions and so forth for you to take up to the White House to discuss with the President, with the National Security Council during that event. How do you remember that situation, that time period, that several weeks in October of 62, and his role in working for you in that?
Well, it's my recollection that that time Adlai Stevenson was our ambassador to the United Nations. And I know Adlai Stevenson well, boyhood days. We both been brought up in Chicago. I know him then. He was, had been very fond of my sister. Frankly, I thought Adlai had a great gift of words that was apparently a weakling. And during the Cuban Missile Crisis, he is ambassador to the UN, thought me should not blockade not disrupt shipments from Russia to Cuba, because the legal counsel to the State Department and Len Meeker said that to interrupt those shipments, to stop their ships, would be illegal without a prior declaration of war. It was equivalent to blockade. You couldn't have a blockade under international law without a prior declaration of war. And the last thing the world would want to do was to declare war on the Soviet Union. We wanted to take these steps interrupting them. Shipments. They'd already sent the missile bodies. The question issue was whether the warheads, yes, the business end of the warheads, had also been shipped to Cuba. Should we? The question issue was it proper for us to stop their ships, search them, and see whether they had warheads aboard them. And I thought we should certainly do that and demonstrate to the world that these fellows were cheats, liars, and threats to the peace of the world. Stevenson thought this would be against international law, etc., etc. We shouldn't do it. And as I remember it, we got into a thing called the XCOM, which was the committee of executive committee to deal with important strategic decisions at the time.
Mm-hmm. Was this the same as the Committee of Principles, which is, I think, what Evelyn Zumwalt referred to?
Yeah. Okay. Committee of Principles. Stevenson was protesting this would be a dreadful thing in contract international law for us to stop these ships. See what they had aboard. And I was of the view to hell with that. Let's make international law. International law is not, it's just a question of precedence. Mm-hmm. There are occasions when it's agreed that you can make international law that's willing to take the consequences. So I've recommended that we stop those ships and search them. And board them. And search them and demonstrate to the world that they really did have warheads aboard, and they were a threat to international peace and to the world, and God knows what. There are others who backed Stevenson's position that you couldn't do that. But my recollection is that I stood up and took issue with the president on the issue. Considered a very rude and unprincipled thing for a young whippersnapper to do. But I felt so strongly about this that I didn't have any worry about arguing with the president. And after a good deal of discussion, some of the others on that committee changed their opinion and came around to my side of the issue, so that there really was a majority of that group who finally concluded that we ought to stop those ships. And but after we'd made that decision, authorized our destroyers to stop the ships and go aboard them and search them. They turned around and headed for home. And I still thought they ought to go and stop them. But as I remembered, McNamara had a different view. McNamara said we oughtn't to press this too hard, we ought to give them a way out. And the president seemed to side with him, but I did not. But the president overruled me. which I regretted. I thought he made a mistake. Mm-hmm. But I think that transcript does, in fact, record the fact that I told the president I thought he was wrong. Mm-hmm. My theory was that, you know, you don't do a great man any good by agreeing with him. The only people who do him any good are those who stand up and tell him he's wrong. He can help you, always has the power to overrule him. But they're the ones who help him.
Admiral Zumwalt told me that Mr. McNamara took a rather direct role in the blockade itself, down to and including showing up over at the flag plot and suggesting to the Admiral that the ships be positioned in certain manners, and that the Admirals were horrified by that because they regarded that as an intrusion upon the operational side of the issue, and that you and Admiral Zumwalt ended up embroiled in this a little bit because Mr. McNamara gave operational orders to Admiral Zumwalt to take to the flag plot and came within a hair of firing him and told you that he would have fired him if he had not gotten the message straight.
That's right. That's my recollection, too.
Do you recall how Mr. McNamara approached you with regards to what Admiral Zumwalt had done with the memorandum and with his own role and maybe being too direct in dealing with the Navy in terms of the blockade?
I remember McNamara being very angry, and I totally persuaded that this micromanagement on the part of McNamara was the wrong way to go about things. These things were too complicated to have even the most minute decisions go up to the Secretary and the President. Some point, or delegate to the forces down below. You want to make your policy as clear as you could. Some point, the man on the spot has to make the decisions.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't agree with that. Fine detail that happens on the spot, that the most important and most subtle decisions take place. That's where the President should involve himself, right at that point of minute detail. And I thought structurally that wasn't the way to run a Navy. Think so.
During the missile crisis itself, because Admiral Zumwalt was your aide, my understanding is that he spent a lot of time running back and forth between the Pentagon, the State Department, the White House, keeping up with you, keeping you abreast of certain matters.
I think that's correct. I think the reason for that was much time involved.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to make some decisions, you know, instantaneously.
I think Admiral Zumwalt indicated to me that for you, for him, and how he remembers the work that you did together during that period, that, that he described it as a pressure cooker.
Oh, absolutely.
Where, again, like you suggested, there was not a lot of time to think about things, where things had to be done. And so how do you remember that environment, working with him in an environment like that, and how does this then demonstrate the sort of service that he rendered to you?
My environment, my recollection was that it appeared that absolutely essential to keep those ships from getting to Cuba, because they might have aboard them the warheads to make those missiles, which were already there in Cuba, operational. And if they were operational, that could really change the nature of the strategic situation, fundamentally making all our cities in the United States vulnerable to a preemptive attack. And even worse than that, make our strategic forces vulnerable.
So your role in this at this point was more in terms of policy rather than operations.
Well, both. Well, I felt so strongly about it that Stevenson was wrong, that the president was wrong, that somebody had to step in and take care of this thing, even though unauthorized to so do, and that I was in a better position to do that than anybody else, and I didn't have any hesitation in so doing.
Mm-hmm.
I knew it to be improper organizationally. But I thought it was necessary to act. Not have, in hindsight, I have a feeling it was.
Mm-hmm. Given that you disagreed with the way McNamara managed the Navy, at least during this position, did you feel that as the civilian head of the service, that you were somehow caught in between the, I guess, the cabinet, with the president, with the Secretary of Defense, and on the other side, with the actual military itself?
I felt very much on the hot seat, yes. Because I thought McNamara was wrong. He was my boss. I thought the president was wrong. I thought the Len Meeker, the head of the legal department, the State Department, was wrong.
Mm-hmm. Given that you disagreed with him, did you feel like this was an environment where you had the freedom to speak your mind freely without the sense that this was creating bad blood or a difficult environment for both
no,
you?
No, I thought I was being bureaucratically, I was in violation of all rules and regulations. I was operating without authority, contrary to the will of the president, contrary to the will of my boss. Contrary to the legal authorities.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing that needed to be done.
Right. Because Admiral Zumwalt was so close to you on this, what sort of a position did this put him in? Other than the fact that McNamara came with an air of ordering you to fire him.
But I think you shared, all the dangers that I shared. But it wasn't his responsibility, it was my responsibility. I took responsibility in my own hands. I knew that what I was doing was contrary to my boss's orders, contrary to the president's will, contrary to the State Department's decisions to what was necessary, that I was acting wholly on my own determination.
Mm-hmm.
And very exciting people.
I imagine. When the issue was resolved, when it seemed that the Soviet Union had been forced to show their hand and back down, was your position at all vindicated by that?
Not really. And I remember I'm terribly cross because those Russian ships turned around. Decided that we should not stop them and board them. And so they went off free and clear and went back to the Soviet Union unharmed by anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And McNamara was very proud of that. So if we hadn't done that, they would have been had their backs up against the wall and there wouldn't have been any reasonable way out of the jam. I thought that's just what I wanted. I wanted to have no way out of the jam for them.
Mm-hmm.
So, I was a naughty boy.
And so, once it was resolved, then did you feel like you had lost favor with the president, or did he respect the fact that you stood your ground on an issue, even though you did not necessarily agree with him?
I think he, I think he respected my position, yeah. In fact, I think I remember one of those meetings where there was the president had thought he decided the issue. We should back Stevenson. And not do anything. Let those ships turn around and escape. I still thought this was a great mistake, but everybody else stood their ground against me, so I was left alone in my agony.
The president respected your position, but if Mr. McNamara was your immediate superior, how did he handle that difference of opinion, both during the crisis itself and once it was resolved. Okay, well, we can change gears. Another one of the main issues, in Admiral Zumwalt's memory at least, of his time with you was the negotiations that led to the test ban treaty. What sort of role did he play for you in that process? Because arms control becomes one of the factors in his career, or knowledge of and expertise in that field. I believe this is when you were Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security.
Well, I have several recollections of those days. One was the meeting in Reykjavik. First afternoon, and it was decided that each side would choose a representative to be a negotiator. More or less, full powers to negotiate, but still odd referendum to the bosses after they got through with the negotiation. They would try to clear away as much of the simplify the issues as much as they could. Clear away all the minor issues and, if possible, come up with an agreed recommendation as to what should be done. And, the Russians chose Marshal Akhramayev. Their top great military man to represent their side. And I was chosen to represent our side. But given a kind of an advisory staff to me, five or six people representing the various facets of the American policy team on these issues. The Undersecretary's Office, ISA, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so, even went into this negotiation at 9 o'clock in the evening. And worked along trying to simplify the various problems. And of course, the most difficult ones were the ones that were still unresolved. And when we got to midnight, and I asked for an hour's time out, because I wanted to go and check with my boss. I can't remember who that was.
This was in the Defense Department.
In any case, checked whoever my boss was, and he said, why don't you go in there and do the best you can, and in any case, it's all a referendum.